This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details.
Now we enlighten you with verses 162 to 165 of chapter Al-An'am from the Holy Quran, recited by Murtaza Fatimi.
A'udhu billahi minash shaytanir rajim. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. قل إن صلاتي ونسكي ومحياي ومماتي لله رب العالمين لا شريك له وبذلك أمرت وأنا أول المسلمين قل أغير الله أبغي ربا وهو رب كل شيء ولا تكسب كل نفس إلا عليها ولا تزر وازرة وزر أخرى ثم إلى ربكم مرجعكم فينبئكم بما كنتم فيه تختلفون وهو الذي جعلكم خلائف الأرض ورفع بعضكم فوق بعض درجات ليبلوكم فيما آتاكم إن ربك
In the name of God, the Compassionate, the Merciful. Say, surely my prayer and my sacrifice and my life and my death are all for Allah, the Lord of the worlds. No associate has He, and this am I commanded, and I am the first of those who submit. Say, what shall I seek, a Lord other than Allah? And He is the Lord of all things, and no soul earns evil but against itself, and no bearer of burden shall bear the burden of another. Then to your Lord is your return, so He will inform you of that in which you differed. And He it is who has made you successors in the land and raised some of you above others by various grades, that He might try you by what He has given you. Surely, your Lord is quick to requite evil, and He is most surely the forgiving, the merciful.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Look at our top stories this hour. Tensions between Russia and Europe over Ukraine taking a turn for the worse, with France planning to expel dozens of Russian diplomats. North Korea threatens to use its nuclear weapons to eliminate the South's army if Seoul decides to launch a preemptive strike. And a new survey finds that suffering has reached unprecedented levels in Afghanistan, with almost the entire nation experiencing dire conditions. It's good to have you with us. It's day 41 of the Russian military offensive against Ukraine, and here's a quick rundown of the theater of war. The White House claims that Russia is shoring up its campaign in eastern Ukraine with probable plans to deploy tens of thousands of soldiers there. The U.S. says Russian forces are pulling away from Ukraine's capital, Kyiv, in a shift toward the eastern regions. Ukrainian officials also say Russia is preparing for a big attack in the east and have urged mass evacuations in that region. Moscow says its drawdown near Kyiv and the northern city of Chernihiv is a goodwill gesture to support peace talks. Ukraine and its allies say Russia was forced to shift its focus to eastern Ukraine after suffering heavy losses near Kyiv. In the south, heavy fighting reportedly continues around the besieged city of Mariupol as Russian forces try to take the city. The International Committee of the Red Cross says its team hasn't been able to reach Mariupol to evacuate civilians due to security conditions. That was the fourth attempt in as many days to reach the city. The Russian foreign minister says Western leaders should examine their own conscience before accusing President Vladimir Putin of committing war crimes in Ukraine. Lavrov's remarks came after earlier on Monday, U.S. President Joe Biden called for his Russian counterpart to be tried for what he called committing war crimes in the Ukrainian town of Bucha. Asked about Biden's comments, Lavrov said the West should first consider its own actions in Iraq and Libya. He said, quote, not all is well with the conscience of American politicians. Separately, U.S. National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan said Washington will consult with its allies about Russia's accountability. Sullivan said the case of alleged incidents in Bucha could be referred to the International Criminal Court. Kyiv claims the recently found mass graves in Bucha and other areas near the capital contain bodies of hundreds of civilians executed by Russian troops. Moscow points the accusing finger at Ukraine, saying it has fabricated images of dead civilians to smear the image of Russia. Political commentator Scott Bennett says the Western countries' accusation that Russia has committed war crimes in Ukraine is in line with their attempts to to create a propaganda campaign against Moscow.
They're interested in psychological warfare and propaganda. That's why the British have held up any inquiry into this incident at the United Nations Security Council, most likely because the British know that they'll be found out to having been involved. The British were instrumental in the White Helmet theatrical operations in Syria, where they would pretend that individuals were wounded or killed, and they were found to be crisis actors. So the British are very well aware that they are most likely going to be exposed as creating this propaganda. They've already been exposed as having Polish film crews hiring actors to pretend that there's all sorts of chaos. And of course, the United States is desperate to try and provoke some sort of international outrage against Russia. So it is no doubt that this is completely fabricated, dramatic, and it fits the perfect model that NATO has always pursued. They did this in Libya as well, when they invented a city in Qatar and pretended that it was Tripoli and did filming of operations there, pretending it was in Libya when it was not. They've also filmed fake beheadings in studios with cameras and studio lights, pretending that it was done in the desert in Libya when it was not.
Tensions between Russia and Europe over Ukraine take a new turn as France says it has decided to expel dozens of Russian diplomats. A French diplomatic source says the country will expel 35 Russian personnel with diplomatic status. The French Foreign Ministry also said the activities of Russian diplomats were considered contrary to security interests of Paris. The decision was part of a wider European initiative after Germany announced it expelled 40 Russian diplomats. The German foreign minister described the move as a response to what she called the unbelievable brutality Russia had unleashed in Ukraine. Moscow has denounced Berlin's move, calling it an unfriendly act, which would worsen bilateral ties. The Kremlin has also vowed to respond to Germany's move. Earlier, Lithuania said it expelled the Russian ambassador and would recall its envoy in Moscow. As the cost of living crisis continues to hit families across Europe, Britain's Muslims are struggling to feed their fasting families this Ramadan, as one charity claims. The news has sent shockwaves as more desperate people must resort to food banks in order to have an iftar meal. Robert Carter reports from London.
Shocking statistics released by a Muslim charity last Friday revealed that a staggering half of all Muslim households in Britain will not have enough money to feed their families when breaking their fast this Ramadan. Islamic Relief estimated that half of all British Muslim households are living in poverty. That's 1.6 million people compared to the 18% of the population in general.
The UK is going through a major financial crisis, with the COVID pandemic and the NATO-inspired conflict in Ukraine pitted as the two main contributors towards skyrocketing inflation and a lack of fuel supply.
As poverty spreads, food banks come under increasing pressure to deliver. London-based Sufra explained their concerns for the situation.
Muslim families in the borough are particularly affected, especially due to the housing benefit cap, for example, which disproportionately affects families that have more than two children, which, you know, applies to a lot of Muslim families. And so there are families that are living in inappropriate accommodation and not accessing the benefits that they should be entitled to because of these unfair policies. All we're doing is seeing numbers rising. We're hearing firsthand from guests how worried they are, especially now that we're in April, we're in this new financial year, and the guests that are coming through the door are extremely worried about the energy bills that are going to hit them this month.
During Ramadan, Muslims who can afford it make a religious donation to help others less well off, called zakat. With the economy wavering, more will be forced to rely on this generosity of strangers just to survive. Robert Carter, London.
North Korea warns that it will attack Seoul with nuclear weapons if it chooses military confrontation or makes a preemptive strike on Pyongyang. The warning came from Kim Yo-jung, the sister of North Korean leader Kim Jong-un. On Friday, South Korea's defense minister said Seoul had accurate missiles, which could, quote, quickly hit any target in North Korea. Kim said it was a very big mistake. for the South Korean minister to talk about an attack on the North. However, she added that Pyongyang opposes war and doesn't view South Korea as its principal enemy. Tensions have been rising on the Korean Peninsula since last month, when the North resumed testing intercontinental ballistic missiles after a five-year pause. Now, Brian Berletic, a writer and political commentator, joins us from Bangkok. Brian, welcome. Thanks for being with us. I want to first hear your thoughts on the nuclear threat and the fact that it came from the North Korean leader's sister, Kim Yo-jung.
Well, his sister has considerable political clout, or at least is engaged with the public quite a bit. And the nuclear threat came after these very reckless, needlessly reckless comments coming from South Korea. People have to remember that there are some about 20,000 U.S. troops in South Korea that the U.S. has for decades designated the Korean Peninsula as one of its principal fronts to encircle and contain China. And they have maintained this environment of belligerence toward the North all of these decades. And the threat is real. The U.S. has carried out serial wars of aggression around the globe, and they are sitting there right on North Korea's border. So I think North Korea's perception of a threat is legitimate, and I think their comments were very measured. They were threatened first by South Korea, and they responded by saying there will be retaliation, but we do not see South Korea as a threat, as an enemy, or as an enemy. So I think this all could have been avoided if South Korea would just focus on coexistence and moving forward together with the North rather than this needless saber rattling.
Mm-hmm. Brian, let's factor in the latest ICBM launch by the North, and also the joint military drills, and also the fact that the new government in South Korea seems to be seeking closer ties with the U.S., which means more joint military drills. And the North Korean leader's sister, Kim Yo-jung, said somewhere else in her statement that Pyongyang opposes war and does not view South Korea as its principal enemy. So who is North Korea's principal enemy?
Precisely. So North Korea's main threat is from the United States. And I would say South Korea's main threat is also from the United States. We can see how devastating a relationship with the United States can be if we look at what's happening to Ukraine right now. And I don't think that the U.S. would hesitate for a moment if it thought it would benefit Washington to wage a similar proxy war against North Korea using South Korea, and likewise use the entire crisis on the Korean Peninsula as a way of antagonizing, encircling, and encroaching upon China. So I think this is another illustration of exactly who the real problem is here. The United States, who has tens of thousands of troops on the peninsula, thousands of miles away from America's own shores. It's, again, a needless and constant provocation for everyone living on the peninsula, not just North Korea.
So you said this was a reckless comment on the part of South Korea's defense minister. And in a time when the tensions have been running high over the past few months between the two Koreas, and such provocative comments and remarks might actually lead to devastating future, and this would change everything. Basically, how do you think South Korea can stave off disaster here?
I think that South Korea could easily avoid this type of danger by just choosing their words very carefully. They can take note of North Korea's missile tests, and they can say that that bothers them without, again, needlessly threatening North Korea, which is the whole reason North Korea is carrying out these tests in the first place, is because they feel threatened, and rightfully so. Again, the presence of U.S. troops there is a very real threat for North Korea. So South Korea, they need to choose their words more carefully. They should, for their own best interests, mm-hmm. choose diplomacy and words crafted toward moving everything toward peace rather than assisting the U.S. in raising tensions on the peninsula.
Brian, thank you so much for joining us. That was Brian Berletic, a writer and political commentator from Bangkok. Moving on, suffering at its peak in Afghanistan. A new study shows that almost all Afghan people consider their living conditions to be so dismal to characterize as suffering. According to the Gallup survey, 94% of Afghans have rated their lives poorly enough to be considered suffering. This is the highest level measured for any country since 2005. The study shows that the percentage of women suffering is higher than men and that women are more pessimistic about their futures. With the entire world now focusing on the conflict in Ukraine, Afghanistan has been deprived of the attention and the humanitarian assistance it much deserves. The situation has become even worse since the Taliban takeover last year. With the world refusing to recognize the Taliban government and the United States freezing billions of dollars worth of Afghan assets, humanitarian aid to the country has almost entirely dried up. And Pakistan's Supreme Court will resume its deliberations on whether Prime Minister Imran Khan's decision to dissolve the parliament to avert a no-confidence vote was legal. Khan lost his parliamentary majority last week, facing a no-confidence motion. Speculations of the Prime Minister losing the vote had been running rife, but the Deputy Speaker blocked a debate on the motion on Sunday, triggering a full-blown political drama. The crisis deepened after Khan asked the presidency to dissolve the National Assembly and called a snap election. A united opposition is calling that decision unconstitutional. Khan's cabinet has been dissolved as well in anticipation of fresh elections. The prime minister is accused of failing to revive the economy and cracking down on corruption. But Khan blames foreign conspiracy and says opposition figures have colluded with the United States to topple him. Washington says it has nothing to do with the current turmoil in Pakistan. Officials in China's largest city and economic hub, Shanghai, are extending restrictions on transportation amid a surge in COVID outbreak. The restrictions will see more transportation networks, including subway lines, suspended. The entire population under lockdown was tested for Omicron on Monday. The mass testing raised the number of asymptomatic infections by almost 25% to over 13,000. Officials have also extended the lockdown to Shanghai's western parts. That means more than 25 million residents will be under restriction until further notice. Tens of thousands of medical and military personnel are overseeing the operation, the biggest since the shutdown of Wuhan, where the first known COVID outbreak took place in the early 2020. The Palestinian Health Ministry says Israeli forces killed over 350 Palestinians in 2021, while injuring more than 16,000 in the same period. The ministry says over 260 Palestinians were killed in the Gaza Strip, mostly during the Israeli war on the enclave last May. The ministry says 90 Palestinians were killed in the West Bank, including the occupied East al-Quds. Among Palestinians killed last year, nearly 90 were children, 60 were women, and 20 were elderly. Most of the injuries were also recorded in the Gaza Strip during Israel's 11-day aggression in May. Meanwhile, a separate report by the Palestinian Prisoner Society says Israel has detained over 9,000 Palestinian children across the occupied territories since 2015. The society says over 160 Palestinian children are currently doing time in Israeli jails.
Well, that's your world news for now. Stay tuned.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Supplication on Tuesdays. In the name of Allah, the all-merciful, the all-compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, and praise is His right, since Him deserves it, abundant praise. I seek refuge in Him from the evil of my soul, for surely the soul commands to evil, except as my Lord has mercy. I seek refuge in Him from the evil of Satan, who adds sins to my sin. I seek protection with Him from every wicked tyrant and unjust sovereign and conquering enemy. O Allah, place me among Thy troops are the victors, and place me in Thy party, for Thy party are the ones who prosper. And place me among Thy friends, for Thy friends no fear shall be upon them, nor shall they sorrow. O Allah, set right for me my religion, for it is the preserving tie of my affair. Set right for me my hereafter, for it is the abode of my permanent lodging, and to it I flee from the neighborhood of the vile. Make life an increase for me in every good, and death an ease for me from every evil. O Allah, bless Muhammad, the seal of the prophets, and the completion of the number of the envoys, and his household, the good, the pure, and his household, the good, the pure, and his companions, the distinguished. And give me on the Tuesday three things. Leave no sin for me unless Thou forgives it, and leave no grief unless Thou takes it away, and leave no enemy, and leave no enemy unless Thou repelst him. By means of In the name of Allah, the best of the names, in the name of Allah, Lord of earth and heaven, I seek to repulse every hateful thing, the first of which is His anger. And I seek to attract every lovable thing, the first of which is His good pleasure. So seal me with forgiveness from Thee, O Patron of Beneficence.
Ramadan, the month of opportunities. In the name of God, salam and welcome to the program. We are in the third day of the blessed month of Ramadan, the month of worship of God. Ramadan is running like a river. How can we thank this great blessing? Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny, says, faith has two halves. One half is patience, and the other half is thanksgiving. Patience on obedience and leaving sins, and thanksgiving for blessings. True thanksgiving of every blessing is to use it correctly. Thanksgiving of the tongue is to use it for prayer, remembrance of God, inviting to truth, and making peace among people. Moreover, the tongue should be prevented from backbiting, calumny, foul words, gossiping, and so on. The eyes must be used for acquiring knowledge and admonishment, and they should be prevented from gazing at forbidden sins. The hands should be used to work and make money in a legitimate way and not wronging others and harming their rights. We should know that everything has been granted by God and our whole being is the divine blessing, which has been given without any demand or prelude. Thus, it is obligatory to thank God without any prelude or condition. The right of God on us is to thank Him through worship without associating any partner to Him. Imam Ali, peace upon him, says, "A group of people worship God for the sake of achieving paradise. This is the worship of merchants. Another group worships God out of the fear of hell. This is the worship of slaves. But the third group worship God only to thank His blessings. This is the worship of free-spirited people." Imam Musa Kazem, peace upon him, the seventh infallible successor of Prophet of Islam, says, "He who says, 'Alhamdulillah,' for a blessing, has fulfilled thanksgiving for that blessing. God has promised in the Quran that thanksgiving will increase our blessings." Dear listeners, the noteworthy point is that thanksgiving is itself a blessing from God. So, we should always be alert to thank God. Imam Sadiq, peace upon him, the sixth infallible successor of the Prophet, says, "He who says, 'Alhamdulillah,' four times in the beginning of the day has indeed fulfilled the thanksgiving of that day. And if he says this in the beginning of the night, has indeed fulfilled the thanksgiving of that night." Ramadan is the month of further inclination to God. It is a very valuable chance for thanking God and trying to cleanse the heart and the soul. Just as we wash clothes, carpets, and every part of the house, we have to wash our inward from evils. Satan is always on alert to draw our attention toward trivial material affairs so that we are far from God. The blessed month of Ramadan is the opportunity to reflect on the eternal salvation and refrain from unending hollow wishes and plan for the lofty life of the hereafter. That's why it has been said that reflecting for 1 hour is better than worshipping for 70 years. The blessed month of Ramadan is the opportunity to get rid of the worldly bonds and pay attention to higher realities. Religious leaders have said that a man's heart is his paradise and hell. If he is pure and righteous, his heart will be like paradise and godly. But if he commits sin, fire will blaze in his heart and can make hell for him. Ramadan is the month of self-building and cleaning the heart. The most beautiful kind of cleaning the heart has been mentioned in the Quran in Ayah 70 of Surah Furqan, which reads, "Accepting those who repent, attain faith and act righteously. For such, Allah will replace their misdeeds with good deeds, and Allah is all-forgiving, all-merciful." As it is clear, such a change not only will cause God to forgive sins, but replace the past sins with good deeds. Fasting helps burn residues in the body. Such like it helps to cleanse the soul from evil characteristics. Dear friends, we have been highly recommended to read the Quran in Ramadan. Imam Ali, peace upon him, says, "Try to recite the Quran every day and night and every now and then, and try to practice the Quran and be obligated to do its religious commitments and commands. This is because the Quran is the covenant of God among people and the program of salvation, and every Muslim should look deeply at the divine program and covenant in every opportunity. Dear friends, Ayah 29 of Surah Sa'd of the Quran reads, "It is a blessed book that we have sent down to you so that they may contemplate its signs, and that those who possess intellect may take admonition." The Quran is the guideline for ideal life, and Ramadan is the best opportunity for learning its teachings. The more we put the Quranic instructions into effect, the closer we will get to the spiritual life and godly world.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
Palestine Declassified.
Hello, I'm Chris Williamson, and welcome to the latest edition of Palestine Declassified, where we investigate the Israeli regime's global war against solidarity with the illegally occupied people of Palestine. Interfaith activities that connect ordinary Muslim and Jewish people to build mutual understanding seems like a good idea. What could possibly be wrong with that? But this benign objective's being manipulated. Today, we'll look at how the Zionist regime is attempting to weaponize goodwill between women of different faiths to normalize Zionism in the Muslim community. I'll be speaking to experts on this issue to find out more after this special report from Palestinian commentator Latifa Abu Chakra about how one influential group is abusing interfaith activities to normalize Zionism.
The name Nisa'at Nashim, a combination of the Arabic and Hebrew words for women, denotes a harmony for all. It elevates the idea of coexistence. The question is, coexistence with what exactly? Nisa'at Nashim was founded in 2016 and is seemingly in potentially terminal decline. Today we ask, what was it in the first place and who exactly is behind it? Nisa'at Nashim claims to be an interfaith partnership between Muslim and Jewish women. In reality, it's a vehicle for normalizing Zionism in the Muslim community. The pro-Israel Board of Deputies of British Jews even admits that it incubated Nisa'at Nashim. The group also claims it has two co-founders, one Muslim and one Jewish. In reality, there was a third undisclosed founder. The first co-founder of Nisa'at Nashim, Laura Marks, was previously the senior vice president of the Board of Deputies. The Board of Deputies, according to its own trustees report, has a close working relationship with the Israeli embassy in the UK through the ambassador, diplomat, professional staff, and strengthened links to the Israeli Ministry of Strategic Affairs and the Israeli Defense Forces. Another co-founder, Julie Siddiqui, has a long history of working with the British Armed Forces. In 2014, she was briefed by the Ministry of Defense on British military operations in Iraq. She claimed that our concerns and feedback have been taken on board and taken seriously. She added, "I can't see any other country in the world where you would have something like this, so it is something that we should be proud of." Denise Joseph is the third undisclosed founder, the only one that remains a director. She describes herself as an ardent Zionist and is the chair of the European Board of One Voice, an anti-BDS organization that pushes normalization propaganda in British schools. Another director, Hifsa Haroon Iqbal, is simultaneously the regional Prevent lead for the West Midlands. Prevent is a British government spying program in which children as young as three can be questioned by counter-terror police without parents present. It is overseen by the Homeland Security Group, which is one of the seven agencies and departments that form the UK intelligence community. But who funds Nisa'at Nashim? Well, It states that it has been funded by the Department for Communities and Local Government and the Board of Deputies. It has also received funding from David Dangor, whose family foundation also funds the Islamophobic Henry Jackson Society and the Board of Deputies. The foundation has also given money to the Jerusalem Foundation, an organization involved in promoting illegal settlement activity in occupied East Jerusalem. So, here we have an interfaith subterfuge organization working to blunt criticism of the Zionist movement in the Muslim community by leveraging personal contacts and friendships. No to Nisat Nashim.
As always, we're joined by our resident expert, David Miller. David is an academic and former professor at Bristol University and a leading British scholarly critic of Israel. He's also a co-founder and co-director of the lobbying watchdog initiative, Spinwatch. We're also joined by the chair of the Islamic Human Rights Commission in London, Masood Sajara. Masood, I think you've expressed some concerns, haven't you, about how interfaith is being used as a sort of soft infiltration by the Zionist movement. Can you say a little bit more about that?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's been clearly seen by Muslims and Jews and others who are opposing Zionism as instrumental in trying to normalize. And indeed, by the claim of those who are involved in this work, themselves admit that this is the reason. Once you get to know people, once you actually have personal relationships, then you're not going to be as harsh against the illegal occupation, apartheid, and the brutal occupation. And that's the task, to do that exactly. And they're really systematically involved in it.
David, you know these links to Nisat Nashim, I mean, are these isolated examples by the Zionist movement, or is this a more widespread thing, do you think?
No, there are two sorts of people who are involved in the leadership of Nisat Nashim. On the one hand, there are people who are Muslim, who are fully paid-up advocates of British counter-terror policy. On the other hand, there are people who are Zionists, who have long experience in the Zionist movement. One of them even used to work for the Israeli government. And this is a very extensive set of connections. And indeed, it goes back further than this. I mean, the setting up of Nisat Nashim was something which was pioneered. The whole idea of these kinds of organizations was pioneered by the Israeli government itself in its Global Forum for Countering Anti-Semitism back in 2013. They started discussing how they could leverage personal friendships in order to protect the state of Israel from criticism.
I mean, Masood, I think you've said that it's a betrayal to work with these groups, and the many Zionists have criticised you for that viewpoint. I mean, how would you respond to that?
Well, I find both from Islamic perspective and sort of main principles of humanity, you can't really get involved on the same platform with racists, with people who are systematically abusing, trying to legitimize racism and illegal occupation and apartheid. You know, to get involved with them on the same platform is really outrageous. I think I would be quite happy to sit down and debate against them, which is something we should do. But to legitimize them and legitimize this sort of activity and keep silence on all these abuses of one of the most brutal illegal occupation, it really is a crime. And I think, you know, as a human rights activist, I won't do it. But in the same time, all the time, systematically, we are in partnership with many Jews who are anti-Zionists, and they are our comrades, and we are really fighting anti-Semitism in a way that nobody else is doing.
I mean, David, there was a reference in the VT that we just saw there to the role of the Ministry of Defence and an allusion to the British Security Services. I mean, do you think that's significant?
It is, I'm afraid. Most of the work of PREVENT, which is the British government's counter-terror policy, and some of the extremism work as well, involves funding a whole series of civil society groups. And these are funded and run through an organisation called the Homeland Security Group of the Home Office, which is a British intelligence agency. And people who are involved with Nisat Nashim, one of their trustees, is a PREVENT coordinator, is effectively an asset of British intelligence. And others involved are associated with organisations which are funded by, secretly funded and covertly funded by the propaganda department of the Home Office. And so they're also, in effect, assets of British intelligence. Now, this is not a technical thing. This is actually how these organisations are run. They're run with influence and money and, indeed, editorial control by British intelligence agencies. And there's no recognition of this in the wider community, and it should be much more widely known.
I mean, it's argued, Masood, is that, building these sort of personal relationships, between communities makes it, less likely that, that people will fall out, as it were. I mean, do you think that's a plausible reason?
Well, that's what they sort of state themselves, those who are involved. Yeah. They say that this is the reason. And they give an example that they did it with the Christian community, and it led to Christian Zionism. And now they're trying to repeat that within the Muslim community. And indeed, it's very frightening. I've seen on Google, if you search, there are some people who identify themselves as a Muslim Zionist. So that is the task. On one side, they're promoting these people because they have access to power. On the other side, they're silencing everybody else.
I mean, David, how do you think these sort of interfaith groups relate to sort of foreign policy strategies of the Zionist regime?
Well, the groups like Nissan Nishim, and there are many others, there's a whole network of interfaith organisations run by similar sorts of people, and sometimes the same people. And they relate very closely to the foreign policy objectives of Israel, of the Zionist state. As I mentioned before, the Global Forum on Countering Antisemitism has been discussing this. It's been a special working group since 2013. They've been discussing it since 2007. And there it's set out very clearly the value of personal relationships and the need to try and leverage these personal relationships to dull down and counter criticism of the state of Israel. And in 2015, their working group made similar sorts of recommendations. There was a person on it, on the working group from the UK, who's also sat on interfaith boards with the Board of Deputies. And only a year after these discussions and proposals were put out by the Global Forum, Nissan Nishim itself is created. So it's almost directly a kind of result of that. It said on the website of the Board of Deputies that it was incubated. It incubated Nissan Nishim. So this is a product of Israel lobby groups directed in a strategy by the State of Israel.
Mm. Yeah, I'm going to say, Masood, I mean, we're often, when these sorts of facts come out, accused of indulging in conspiracy theories. I mean,
well, the facts speak for themselves. There is not a single rabbi in interfaith structure which is anti-Zionist or pro-Palestinian. You know, pro-Palestinianism is actually a crime when it comes to these groups. They're actually... There's no good pro-Palestinian, and everything is to do with promoting Israel. It's very clear.
Interesting, yeah. Well, look, let's pause the discussion there for a moment if we can, because we've got another report from Latifa Abu Chakra about what she found when she recently attended a Nissan Nishim meeting on Ramadan.
Nissan Nishim claims to be all about mutual understanding and inspiring leadership and social change, but we found that it seems to be more about normalising Zionism and collaborating with British intelligence agencies and counter-terrorism work. I wanted to see how this works in practice, so I went to one of their online meetings. Before I went, I checked out the person running the meeting, a Muslim woman called Saliha Islam. It turns out, like many others associated with Nissat Nishim, she has connections to the counter-extremism apparatus of the British government. She is associated, for example, with Faith's Associates, a group which has worked covertly with the Home Office's Homeland Security Group, a part of the British intelligence apparatus. I wanted to ask some questions about Nissat Nishim. Let's see.
I wanted to know that, given the Board of Deputies have said that it incubated Nissat Nishim and the fact that it supported it financially, and the Board of Deputies saying that it has a close working relationship with the Israeli embassy, why would Muslims trust this organisation? And there is one in particular for you, Saliha. Given the connections that you have to Prevent and the research, information and communications unit in the Home Office, of which are both intelligence projects, if I could just get my question out so that we're clear. And Saliha, you're linked directly to an asset of British intelligence. Why would anyone believe that Nissat Nishim is not a British intelligence asset?
May I answer, as a trustee of Nissat Nishim, the first question? And We were not incubated. We have separated ourselves. We are now registered with the Charity Commission. We are an independent entity and no longer have links. Yes, we have relationships and we do work with Board of Deputies, especially when we are dealing with anti-Semitism. And I let Saleha respond. Saleha, this is about Ramadan. So
yeah, this is, yeah, so this is really about Ramadan. And
yeah, that's what I'm saying. This program is
the... Yeah, Hajra, I can speak. Thank you. I don't know what you're talking about in terms of RICO, whatever, and also in terms of PREVENT. As a director of many organizations, you have to work with different organizations across the board. So I am not part of anything. I'm not a PREVENT office or anything like that.
Can we take this offline? Sorry, Latifa, I'm sorry, I'm going to cut you off here.
I'm here asking these questions because obviously it's...
I realize that.
About spiritual matter. If we're talking about Ramadan and we're talking about the spiritualness of Ramadan and the practice, then we also need to uphold the good. As it says in the Quran, you know, you uphold the good and you forbid the evil. If PREVENT targets Muslim communities and puts children as young as 3 years old under the inspection of police officers without their parents.
So I think you're going off track here. So I'm sorry, we can't have that. Sorry, Anna. I'll just let everybody else know that, I mean, if this sort of discussion goes off, we will have to remove you from the site.
Overall, it seems like an attempt to get women to get on with each other personally, so that it's more difficult in the future for them to argue when Israel next attacks Gaza or indulges in ethnic cleansing in East Jerusalem.
Wow, that was a pretty damning indictment, Masood. I wonder whether you could say whether, you know, Muslims in general are aware of the sort of agenda behind what this looks like a seemingly innocent venture.
No, they're not. I mean, I think very large section of Muslim community on grassroots, they're really not aware of it. They are committed to sort of having a relationship with the Jewish community and the Christian community because they live in the West. And this is actually basically a covert thing to use that sentiment of ordinary people and sort of bring Zionism and legitimization of Zionism and silencing of the community through backdoor. And I think we need to have alternative to this. People who want to have a relationship with Jewish community, which we should promote, should not be forced to have it with the Zionists as a representative of the Jewish community. Mm.
David, what do you make of this notion of faith associates that came up?
Well, faith associates is one of these civil society groups which appears to be a Muslim grassroots entity, but which is in actuality covertly funded through RICU, the propaganda department of the Home Office, which is itself part of the British intelligence apparatus. So Faith Associates, which the chair of this meeting is associated with, is on their website as being working for them, is effectively part of an organisation which has been a British intelligence asset. Now, that's a really quite a serious allegation to make, but it's perfectly clear that that's the case. It's just that nobody really talks about it in those terms. They say, well, it's not a very good organisation, or they don't like it, or its politics are dodgy. But actually, the issue here is this is an organisation which is being used by the British intelligence agencies to penetrate the Muslim community and to make sure that they can undermine pro-Palestinian activism. And that's the purpose.
Masood, what's your thoughts about the connections to... I think many people regard as the kind of racist PREVENT strategy and this organisation. I mean, how do you...
Well, I think what happened after 9/11, it was happening before, but to much lesser degree. After 9/11, Israeli intelligence services became much more involved in directing the direction of anti-terrorism in this country. And as experts, it's almost like saying that we want to deal with how we deal with the black community, so we went to apartheid state to get some clues. This is outrageous. And that has been contributing to this factor that Zionism and promotion of Zionism or normalization has become one element of anti-terrorism. And, you know, Cameron, for example, said it very clearly. Good Muslims are the ones who have relationship with the Jewish community, this. And even things like Big Iftar. it really is there to inject the on behalf of the Jewish community, Zionist community, in there, into the mosque, to actually normalize. That has to stop.
Mm. I mean, David, you talked a bit about the significance of the role of the British intelligence. Maybe say a bit more about the British intelligence's involvement and role in this whole process.
Well, there's an organisation, used to be an organisation in the Home Office called the Office for Security and Counterterrorism. And it's now been renamed the Homeland Security Group. Not many people know that. Mm. And it runs a whole slew of counterterrorism and counter-extremism organisations, Muslim civil society organisations all over the country. They have a different number of different programmes for that, for both counterterrorism and for counter-extremism. Now, these are organisations which are given free help by a PR agency. Now, some of the time, these organisations themselves don't really know that this PR agency, which is helping them for free, is actually contracted directly to RICU, the propaganda agency of the Home Office, which is an intelligence agency. And they don't know that in secret, when they go to the hub, as it's called, of this PR agency, that there are two intelligence personnel sitting in the small office who are covertly there and pretending to be simply members of the marketing agency, helping them with their marketing campaigns, and that they have, at every stage of the operation, editorial control over every word and every comma in every campaign that's run by these organisations. Now, that's something which is not known about, which comes from leaked documents from inside RICU, and that's what we see here. This is an organisation, one of many, many organisations, which are run by or in the interests of British intelligence. We say in the vocabulary of the intelligence services themselves, these are assets of British intelligence. Mm-hmm. If you look at the MI5 website, they define assets, covert human information sources, in that way. These are not officers of MI5, but they are assets. And that's what we find in this kind of organisation, including in the case of Nishan Nashim. One of the trustees is actually a prevent officer, who is effectively working directly for the intelligence services.
So they're kind of acting as sort of infiltrators, but what's the aim? I mean, what are they seeking to achieve?
Well, the aim is twofold. I mean, on the one hand, there's a normalisation of Zionism, which is the aim of the Israeli government and the Zionist movement. But the British government are on board for part of that. They want to help that, but because they want to penetrate Muslim communities to take the sting out of pro-Palestinian activism. That's what they've been doing since 9/11, targeting Muslims because they see Muslims as being a significant source of opposition to British foreign policy, as indeed they are. Mm-hmm. So it's an attempt to penetrate the Muslim community, to damp down pro-Palestinian sentiment, and to certainly damp down sentiment which opposes British foreign policy, which, of course, as we see, every day goes from worse to worse.
Masood, the information that we've revealed in this report today, I think, is pretty damning. How do you think Muslim organisations and the Muslim community in general should respond to the information that we've revealed in this programme?
Really, there are very dangerous sort of concepts for the future of Muslim community. These concepts that being pro-Palestinian automatically or makes you a terrorist or prone to terrorism is something that unfortunately has been established by the security forces and, being pushed by the Zionists and their elements. And that is what is being promoted. You know, we got youngsters having a badge of Free Palestine being referred to prevent. And, you know, so the actual fact is to silence pro-Palestinianism through prevent, through terrorism, through anti-terrorism, and demonize the whole section of people, replace the leadership into people who are already on sort of prevent payrolls, and they're actually looking for better jobs and better prospect, and the security forces and the government is pushing that line. This is actually very dangerous because what it does is actually doesn't address the real concern of ordinary citizens, be it Muslims or others, who are asking, saying why we are not dealing with the issue of apartheid, why we are not dealing with the issue of war crimes, why we are not dealing with the issue of illegal occupation, and we are silencing, if anything, we are silencing people using these elements of anti-terrorism, etc., etc. We need to liberate ourselves from this. If we are going to sort of have a prosperous Muslim community, which is independent but supportive of our society, we need to actually eliminate these sort of prevent and intelligence services from making decisions which direction it should go. I mean, David, what do you think then should be done about these sort of covert manipulative groups? Do you think they should be registered maybe as agents of a foreign power, or just closed down altogether perhaps?
Well, I think that the idea of registering them as an agent of a foreign power has a certain attractiveness. Of course, you'll know that the Americans did this in 1938, before the Second World War, because there were Nazis operating in the US in service of Nazi Germany, and they did this Foreign Agents Registration Act, which exists to this day, and which Zionist groups, as well as other groups from foreign powers, have to register and disclose their activities. So I think that would be fantastic. Let's register all the Zionist organizations and force them to disclose what it is they're doing to try and influence government policy. Fantastic, let's do that. It's already been discussed in Parliament. We should do this, but of course only in relation to our official enemies, in relation to Russia, for example. But, you know, I don't object to that in relation to Russia, but let's make sure we have all the other countries there too.
Okay, well, thanks very much indeed, both of you. I'm afraid we've run out of time, but thank you for joining us. We'll be back next week with more news and analysis on Palestine Declassified. So until next time, this is Chris Williamson saying bye for now.
In the limelight.
Even mild SARS-CoV-2 infections can amplify a person's chance of developing diabetes, especially for those already susceptible to the disease. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written by Claire Watson, writer. This article is published under the heading Diabetes Risk Rises After COVID, Massive Study Finds. Stay tuned for more. People who get COVID-19 have a greater risk of developing diabetes up to a year later, even after a mild SARS-CoV-2 infection, compared with those who never had the disease. A massive study of almost 200,000 people shows. The research, published in The Lancet Diabetes and Endocrinology earlier this month, is one of a growing number of studies showing that COVID-19 can increase a person's risk of diabetes month after infection. When this whole pandemic recedes, we are going to be left with the legacy of this pandemic, a legacy of chronic disease for which healthcare systems are unprepared, says a study co-author Ziad Al-Ali, chief researcher for Veterans Affairs, St. Louis Healthcare System in Missouri. Al-Ali and Yan Shi, an epidemiologist also at the VA St. Louis Healthcare System, looked at the medical records of more than 180,000 people who had survived for longer than a month after catching COVID-19. They compared these with records from two groups, each of which comprised around 4 million people without SARS-CoV-2 infection who had used the VA healthcare system either before or during the pandemic. The pair previously used a similar method to show that COVID-19 increases the risk of kidney disease, heart failure, and a stroke. The latest analysis found that people who had had COVID-19 were about 40% more likely to develop diabetes up to a year later than were veterans in the control groups. That meant that for every 1,000 people studied in each group, roughly 13 more individuals in the COVID-19 group were diagnosed with diabetes. Almost all cases detected were type 2 diabetes, in which the body becomes resistant or doesn't produce enough insulin. The chance of developing diabetes rose with increasing severity of COVID-19. People who were hospitalized or admitted to intensive care had roughly tripled the risk compared with control individuals who did not have COVID-19. Even people who had mild infections and no previous risk factors for diabetes had increased odds for developing the chronic condition, says Al-Ali. Of the people with COVID-19 who avoided hospitalization, an extra 8 people out of every 1,000 studies had developed diabetes a year later compared with people who were not infected. People with a high body mass index, a measure of obesity and a considerable risk factor for type 2 diabetes, had more than doubled the risk of developing diabetes after a SARS-CoV-2 infection. Given the extraordinary number of COVID-19 cases globally, 480 million confirmed cases and counting, the modest increase in diabetes risk could correspond to a drastic rise in the number of people diagnosed with the disease worldwide. If the observed trends hold true, says Jonathan Shah, an epidemiologist at the Baker Heart and Diabetes Institute in Melbourne, Australia. But the findings might not translate to other groups of people. The U.S. veterans in the study were mostly elder white men, many of whom had elevated blood pressure and were overweight, putting them at high risk of developing diabetes, says Gideon Meyerowitz-Katz, an epidemiologist studying diabetes at the University